Hey, welcome back to another episode of E-commerce on Tap, brought to you by ISBA and Sourcify. I'm your host, Nathan Resnick, joined by my co-host, Aaron Alperter. Aaron, let's give a quick rundown of what E-commerce on Tap is.
Yeah, so what we do is we have a lot of fun. We love looking at different companies in the venture ecosystem. We tell their founding story, reverse engineer their supply chain, and talk about their impact and their potential exit opportunities. So it's really the highlight of my week.
And today we're talking about Harry's. So do you want to give a quick overview of Harry's? I mean, most people in e-commerce, I would assume, know what Harry's is, but maybe some people don't.
Yeah, so they're an American company that manufactures and sells shaving equipment and other men's personal care products. And so I used them today. You've got a beard, so I'm going to guess that you didn't use them today. But I don't know, it's a good name for a shaving company, Harry's.
It is. I'm excited to dive into their story, their funding, their growth. It's really just pretty incredible to see the scale that they've gotten to. But before we do that, what kind of tidbits in the e-commerce world caught your eye this week?
Well, there is a massive tectonic impact happening in the small parcel world right now. I actually just wrote an article about it. You can find it on LinkedIn. But it's about USPS effectively killing the Workship program. For those of you who aren't familiar, DHL eCommerce, OSM, UPS Mail Innovations, those types of companies, they are a low-cost provider. Those companies will go to the warehouse, pick up the packages, sort them, and then deliver them to the post office, usually pretty close to the destination. And then the post office does that final mile. And that program has worked for decades, and they have both benefited from it. Well, what the USPS is doing is they're now raising the prices between 25% and 40% based on these induction models, and it's effectively going to kill this program. And so, anytime you see parcel rates going up in one sector, it's going to impact everything else. And so in the article I write on LinkedIn, I talk about kind of what is going to happen to FedEx and UPS. What's USPS going to do from this? What's DHL going to do? And then some other thoughts there. So that's been on my mind.
I like that. Yeah, what caught my eye is ByHeart, which is like a next generation infant formula nutrition company, raised $95 million to basically vertically integrate their manufacturing. So they now have their own end-to-end manufacturing facility. And in total, they've raised $395 million. So pretty cool to see this, you know, e-commerce brand that started in 2016 grow to this scale and just take a really, you know, vertically integrated supply chain approach. I think we should do an episode on ByHeart. Pretty cool to see their fundraising announcement and everything they've done. The other, you know, interesting tidbit I saw is Temu is cooling off in America. And for those that didn't hear our Temu episode, definitely go back. It was one of my favorite, especially after they spent like, you know, $1 billion on Meta that we uncovered on that episode. It was pretty nuts to see. But Temu is apparently kind of taking their foot off the gas in America. And it's kind of crazy to see. And I think, you know, we both predicted that, you know, are these models sustainable in America in terms of, you know, these small parcel shipments that are, you know, going through Section 321 and not paying any duties or tariffs on those parcels and, you know, being shipped directly from, you know, their suppliers in China. So pretty interesting to see that after spending, you know, billions of dollars in America, they're kind of cooling off and now focusing, the article says, in the Wall Street Journal on Europe. So we'll see. Yeah.
You mean it wasn't a good business model to lose $30 for every package you deliver?
No, yeah, it's crazy. I mean, I definitely recommend everyone look and listen to that episode because Aaron and I uncovered a lot on the Temu episode. And it was just kind of crazy to dive into their business and how it works and their supply chain and the scale and the amount that they're spending on ads was insane. But let's start here. So we've got like a pretty kind of interesting David versus Goliath e-commerce saga that we'll be diving into today. Before we dive into, you know, the David of our story, which is Harry's, do you want to cover Gillette and kind of their background and the data behind this just huge company?
Yeah, happy to do that. Before that, I kind of want to ask you, what's your first shaving experience? Do you remember that?
That's a good question. Honestly, I think I just used like an electric like shaver that like my dad gave me, said, hey, like you're starting to grow like a little bit of a beard, like just use this. And I've kind of gone back and forth with razors and electric at this point in my life. And I don't know, I I usually keep like a little scruff, so I don't go with a razor anymore. But, you know, sometimes if it's a very special occasion, I'll be very clean shaven.
Well, no, it's something special if you're clean shaven.
Yep.
I was quite similar. My dad has always used electric shavers growing up, and like he would do it when he's driving or just, you know, in the bathroom. And so when I was 12, 13, 14, I can't remember when I started using one, but I had one, I think my aunt bought for me as like a Christmas gift. I think she spent like $7. This was before Timo, so maybe it would have been better if we got on Timo. But it kind of felt like a lawnmower on my face and was just like ripping the hair off versus actually doing anything. And so pretty early on, I switched over to actual straight razors, and I shave pretty much every day. It's usually a big occasion if I didn't shave. So I think I'm the opposite of you, where people will look at me and like, if it's been a couple of days, they're like, whoa, what's going on there?
I'm curious, is it part of your morning routine?
Yeah, it is. And so I've kind of gone back and forth between, I used to like do shaving cream and shave like at the sink. But I would usually get the sink really nasty and my wife didn't like that. So now I shave in the shower. And so it's like just part of that routine.
There you go. Makes sense. Interesting. Yeah. I think for listeners, I mean, I'm curious, do people use electric or razors? You know, that's an interesting question. That's a good question for our listeners. Let us know on LinkedIn or Twitter. Aaron and I both are pretty active on those platforms, but let's dive into Gillette. So kind of, when did Gillette start and how did they get to become this, you know, monster of a business?
Yeah. So King Camp, that was his name. So King Camp Gillette was born in 1855. He's the protagonist of the story. First off, if you're thinking of a baby name, King Camp, that's one heck of a name. But anyways, so his home was destroyed in the Great Chicago Fire of 1871. And so he was trying to figure out how he was going to support his family. And so he decided to become a salesman. And he met an inventor, and that inventor imparted a piece of wisdom, which will ring true to every SaaS founder out there today, and said that a successful invention is one that is purchased over and over again by satisfied customers. So he kind of took this idea, put it in the back of his mind, and was just looking for this perfect business. In 1895, after playing with a lot of different ideas and thinking through it, he suddenly had a brilliant idea one day in the morning, and it was an entirely new razor. That was going to be safe, inexpensive, and a disposable blade. And at the time, you might see like old Disney movies. They have that big, long knife looking thing. I'm thinking like Peter Pan when Shmi is taking care of that. But you know that's what people shave with. And it was a delicate thing. Barbers used to shave people. And so you just think about leaning back with some shaving cream and someone with a knife at your throat. That's how they used to do this. And so his thought was, hey, maybe we don't have Edward Scissorhands do this, and let's find something that can be disposable. And so in 1901, he was kind of in some friendly competition with some scientists from MIT, and he proved them wrong by showing that you could produce disposable and thin blades that could be used for shaving. In 1904, he patented his safety razor, and then 1906, it was already an international success. So only 2 years after founding, they had offices in London and Mexico, and manufacturing plants in Canada and France, and just this huge European distribution network in addition to the U.S. In 1914, we had some government intervention in World War I, and the U.S. issued Gillette safety razors to the entire armed forces. And so by the end of the war, some 3.5 million razors and 32 million blades were in military hands. And so you converted the entire nation. All of these young men that were told they had to shave pretty much every day had gotten used to using Gillette razors and took that back. In 1920, he improved it a little bit more, better angle, better grip. And between 1915 and 1925, his business grew by 10x. And so just this absolute rocket ship. If they had podcasts back then, we'd be talking about Gillette as this amazing disruptive force.
Let's take a pause and dive in real quick, because there's very few private companies that have had the scale of distribution that Gillette had during World War I. I mean, imagine you're Gillette and the U.S. government issues a Gillette razor to every soldier. I mean, that's incredible. And just, I haven't heard of distribution like that ever. I mean, that's like insane to think about. And then, you know, all these men that are coming home from the war and the battlefield, they've been using a Gillette razor, and they're probably used to using it at that point, and it kind of maybe became part of their routine. So they continue that at home. I mean, to me, that seems like a huge turning point in their business to have that distribution. I mean, that's insane.
Regulatory capture is an amazing thing if you can get it.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow.
Well, so kind of getting back with the kind of chronology here. So basically the business is on fire, and through the 50s and 70s and 80s, they are just innovating this. They're adding the lubricating strip. They're making the heads more flexible. In 1998, they add the three blades. In 2005, Gillette is actually purchased by P&G for several billion dollars. And in 2006, they kind of have the five blade thing, which got made fun of by SNL. Do you remember the skit, by the way?
I've seen it. It's kind of, yeah, it's funny.
Yeah, basically what it is look it up on YouTube. But they make fun of the fact that Gillette keeps adding all these razor blades, and they have like 25 razors, and it's just like cutting people's heads off to get that super close shave. But that was kind of their innovation. They haven't added a sixth blade or a 10th blade yet, but now the innovation is really in like heated blades or chargeable blades with handles with a wireless charger, things like that. And so it's just really interesting that, you know, Gillette is this massive company. They have an amazing story, this amazing exit, all of this distribution, and they're really the standard. And by the kind of early 2010s, they had a 70% market share. And I remember, I think the first razor that I ever used was Gillette. And I don't know if they still do this, but they used to mail razors to people when they were just turning 18 and just saying, here's a free razor. And you get that trial, just like those World War I soldiers, you get that trial and you're like, oh, this is good. This is nice. I want to use it because it is pretty great. So they're still the biggest player by far. They have like 50% market share, even after everything that Harry's and Dollar Shave Club and the others have done. And it's just really interesting that way.
Yeah, it's pretty incredible. And I think the other note here is there are a ton of patents and kind of legal, you know, security measures around design and technology with razors and this, you know, whole industry, which is different than a lot of CPG industries and other, you know, e-commerce industries. It's not like, you know, there's some razor blade designs that are patented and some, you know, handle designs that are patented. I mean, it's kind of crazy to think about, but, you know, unlike other CPG products, the industry is not necessarily commoditized. I think number one, because of the patents, but number two, as we'll dive into a bit more, the supply chain. You know, there's not like hundreds of different suppliers that can produce these razors. There's maybe like 100 or dozens, if that can produce these razors at scale. So I think it's a lot different than a lot of these other industries that we talk about on e-commerce on tap, because, you know, there are like kind of moats, if you will, to these companies.
Yeah, there's a reason that Gillette was making billions of dollars a year in profit. I mean, like to have those kind of margins means that it's hard to do. So it's really interesting.
Yeah. And I think so from a manufacturing standpoint, you know, most of it is actually in North America and Europe. And this is because the high levels of automation that come to play when we're producing razor blades. And there's a lot of vertical integration across these manufacturers. So the secret sauce in the industry is the grinding process where the razors are made consistently sharpened in large quantities. As you can imagine, like you don't go one by one producing each blade, you do this at vast scale. And that is what, you know, keeps each blade identical. And so I think it's interesting to see that, you know, this is a lot different than a lot of the supply chains we talk about in e-commerce on tap.
Yeah. Have you ever shaved with a bad razor before?
Yeah, it's horrible. It's like a cheap bad one. I was like, gosh, I was like, it was like one of those, you know, packs you get from like CVS or something. I was like, oh, it's like, you know, 20 razors for $5 or something. And I was like, oh my gosh, I'm not doing that again.
How can I go wrong? Like, oh, it turns out that you can have a huge like scar on your face. Like that's
yeah.
So it's like you said, it's really hard. I mean, manufacturing razors requires special steel, special machining skills. And, you know, for most of the history, most of these factories or players were owned by Gillette. And so they have like basically locked up this capacity, and where there were independent factories, a lot of them were at capacity. They didn't have excess capacity sitting around to work with other folks. And so, you know, as we were kind of going through this, I had this thought in my head. I want to kind of ask you, do you think it's more difficult in this case to market a new brand or to manufacture the blades?
That's a good question. I think, are we talking about market the brand in today's market or just in general?
If you were to start today and say, I'm going to make a razor brand and like, I'm going to do that, or I'm going to start a razor manufacturing company, yeah. Which one would be harder?
I don't know. I think they're both extremely hard in today's market. I mean, given where their supply chain stands and the scale that you have to be at to even start one of these brands, that's, you know, hard to fathom. And then from a marketing standpoint, I mean, I feel like almost every angle that I could think of has probably already been done or tried. You know, Dollar Shave Club is one that comes to mind, and that's probably the angle that I would go with. But, you know, that's already been done. So I don't know. I'm curious, what do you think is harder?
I think manufacturing, like 1,000%. The idea is like you have to be so good at this, and your customers will tolerate perfection. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter how many you make, if they are inconsistent or not good, like you're not going to have any customers, and that's hard to bounce back from is if you have poor quality. And so it is so hard in my mind to be able to do that at scale, cost effectively, and to do well. And like, don't get me wrong, the marketing part is hard, but I feel like there are more solutions out there that can help you solve for that, as opposed to learning how to, you know, take a, you know, millimeter thick piece of steel and grinding it down to a consistent edge.
Yeah, that's a good point. And I think too, I mean, a lot of people don't realize the size of the industry. Like this year, over $36 billion of like shaving products will be sold worldwide. I mean, that's a big market, and it's growing over 3% a year. So, you know, more people are shaving every year, which I don't know if that's good or bad, but hey, hopefully, you know, the population is growing. So maybe that's helping grow the market. But also one quick note here is that pre-shave and aftershave creams are typically analyzed within the industry because it's really specific, obviously, for shaving use. And I think that's kind of unique about the industry because there's very few other industries that kind of have like sub products, whether they be like cross sells or upsells or however you want to pitch them, like be considered like part of the shaving market, right? So we're not just talking about the blades themselves and the razors themselves. We're talking about, you know, the pre-shave and aftershave creams, which, as we'll see with Harry's, has helped them expand quite a bit too.
Yeah. I was just thinking that makes sense because shaving cream you really don't use for anything else. Although we just had my son's birthday party a few months ago, and I love my wife, but for some reason she decided it would be a great idea to let all these 4 and 5 year old kids play with shaving cream on our porch. And like it was like on the fan, it was on the wall. It took forever to clean this up, but they loved it. I don't know. So that's probably a very small portion of the shaving cream sales that are there is toddlers messing with it.
That's funny. Well, let's dive into the founder stories. Do you want to discuss and dive into who founded Harry's?
Sure. So we've got two main founders. So Andy Katz Mayfield and Jeffrey Rader. And I'll just kind of go through their background. Start with Andy. So he graduated from Duke University, and his degree was in public policy. And he thought that he was going to kind of get into State Department, those sorts of things. But he ended up getting a MBA from Stanford and worked briefly for the MBA. But he got reconnected to Jeff at Bain & Company. They were actually both from the Boston area. Only lived a couple of towns apart, but met each other initially as an associate consultant. He was at Bain for a few years and then went to Charles Bank and did some other work before starting Harry's. So very, very accomplished, very smart guy in his own right. Jeff is really interesting. So if you look at his LinkedIn picture, you just kind of get a sense of his personality. It's you know, you think LinkedIn, this is your most professional view. It's him with shaving cream mustache. So that just gives you a little flavor of who Jeff is. But he studied international studies, and he got an MBA from Wharton in 2010, and was one of the co-founders of Warby Parker. And, you know, he was there. He started with two other founders while he was at Wharton, and then, you know, had promised that he was going to go back to investment banking. And so he actually leaves Warby Parker in order to make good on that commitment. I don't know if they were paying for his school or something like that. But he had left and kind of was thinking about D2C stuff before coming back and starting Harry's. And the interesting thing is that they, you know, you think about Warby Parker and what a transformational company. And to see that actual link between Harry's is pretty remarkable. And so I think that Jeff is in the small group of people, like you know, Richard Branson or Elon Musk that can say that they started multi-billion dollar companies, which is not, you know, 2 or 3 billion, but multiple billion dollar companies.
Yeah, it's pretty incredible to hear, you know, their background, and especially Jeff's, you know, starting and founding Warby Parker before this. But I think the idea for Harry's, you know, kind of came from Andy, in terms of he was going to buy a razor at a gas station, and they were locked up because people usually shoplift them at gas stations. The brand that he probably was trying to buy, you know, Gillette, was trying to sell him on the technology and the innovation of the product. And he thought that it was just too much. It was too over the top. And he knew that he was overpaying, but, you know, he had no real options because the cheap options were just a bad choice. And so I think he kind of connected the dots with Jeff, you know, drawing similarities to Warby and the eyeglass industry and how that was set up. And they both talked about shaving becoming this category ripe for disruption. And so I think it's just interesting to see, because at this time, like, they kind of hit a similar chord that Warby Parker had hit in the eyewear market, but for shaving. And that, I think, was really kind of the genesis for the brand for Harry's. So it's, you know, pretty amazing to see at this time that there were so many categories that kind of were, quote unquote, untapped by DTC companies, that we've seen, you know, grow tremendously well today.
Well, just to remind us, I mean, the internet was very, very different. It almost didn't exist. I mean, Warby Parker launched in a GQ magazine ad. Like, that's how they launched. And, you know, you think about 2010, 2011, 2012, Shopify was barely a thing. Right, it just was starting to kind of be put together. Facebook advertising was very new. People really didn't trust it. And so by and large, this was an element of a way new way of just interacting with folks online. And I wonder, Nathan, do you think it's possible for any company other than a DTC company to have challenged Gillette at this period in time?
It's a good question. I mean, I think Gillette had the distribution. They had this powerhouse brand that they still have today. I mean, I think, you know, you had to relate to the customer in a different way, right? Because, you know, obviously Gillette was trying to be, quote unquote, innovative with its products. They were making billions of dollars a year in profit. And they had, like, you know, a chokehold on this shaving market, really, in America. I mean, it's pretty incredible if you dive into the numbers and just how profitable they were at the scale that they were at and the percent of market share that they owned. And so I think you had to create a brand that really related to the, you know, customer in a different way. And that's what, you know, Harry's did, really, is I think they really were personable to men, right? Like, they wanted a name that wasn't like some crazy innovation. Like, they wanted something that was relatable, right? And I think that is really, really what drove the success here, is just how relatable the product was, and you know, just the ethos that they created in their branding.
Yeah, that makes a ton of sense. I mean, I agree with you. And I think that if you think about the fact that in the early 2010s, the ecosystem around marketing and how you just interact with people, it changed dramatically. Like, we went away from TV and broadcast and all those sorts of things to now this new idea of social media. And if Gillette had been on the forefront of social media and had really adopted that, then they probably would have choked out Harry's and anyone else that was able to do that. But because they were, you know, I would do the same thing. I would stick on, like, what's making money and, like, not waste on these unproven channels. And so it's an interesting thing where, because the market had changed and Gillette hadn't moved fast enough, there was this opening where you could talk to consumers in a different way.
Yeah. And I think too, like, if we talk about how Andy and Jeff really earned or gained conviction in the shaving market, they did so with a research-driven approach, right? So number one, they found that P&G, that at the time owned Gillette, was making just an insane amount of profit, and the margins were super high, so it meant that there was opportunity there. And then they used university databases to run customer surveys or consumer surveys about, you know, shaving and the industry, and they had a lot of great feedback and encouragement from these surveys that they ran. And they tried, and then they tried, number three, they tried every product on the market. So they tried, you know, all the Gillette products and all their competitors, and they tested the quality, the packaging, the design, everything you could think of. And that's when they started to dive into manufacturing and did kind of this whole scope of the manufacturing landscape you know, trying multiple manufacturers that they quickly found out were not up to the task, mainly because of quality issues. So I think they set a very high bar on quality from the start. And, you know, they thought that their product was not going to be revolutionary, you know, quote unquote revolutionary, but they knew that it had to be high performing in you know, this world of shaving at the time. So I think it's kind of unique in terms of the way that they stumbled across their original manufacturer that, you know, they end up acquiring, but they were reading a specialized shaving blog, which goes to show the amount of research that they were doing. And they learned about a small German manufacturer named Feintechnik, and they were doing advanced shaving products. And so after some Googling, they were finally able to find their contact information, get some samples, and they found that these were really, you know, good quality razors. And so they needed, you know, product to obviously have some customization. They didn't just want to white label a razor off the shelf, both from a design perspective as well as from a functionality perspective. And so they, you know, created and got to a special agreement with the manufacturing company in order to get Harry's off the ground. And so it was pretty crazy to see the scale of their first PO, but their first PO was for 1 million blades, which is like insane for a first PO. I mean, how would you feel, Aaron, if you're, I don't know how much each blade costs. I mean, probably I would assume 1 million blades is going to cost, I don't know, $300,000 to $500,000 or so.
It was 50 cents I was able to find. So their first PO was about $500,000.
So $500,000, they're taking a big swing from the get-go. I mean, how would you feel if you're placing a first PO for $500,000?
Well, the other thing too is they hadn't had any funding, right? I don't even know if they had incorporated the company at this point. And so like there's part of me, which is like the cynic that says, okay, you know, they placed this PO, they haven't given any money yet. Worst case scenario, they will just, you know, say, oh, we're not going to do this. We bankrupt the company. And like that PO is with the company. And so we're good. But on the other hand, it's like, oh, shoot, you know, this is the scale of what's going to be. And it also shows, you know, goes to your investors to say, hey, this is a real thing. Like, we need your money in order to do this. And so it's a really interesting piece there where, to some extent, I think it was easier to make that kind of commitment because they didn't have that much skin in the game, if that makes sense. But at the same time, it obviously you don't want to be throwing out numbers that that you don't think you can deliver on.
Yeah. And I think too, so they ended up, you know, raising a seed round of a funding of $4 million was their initial seed round. And I think a lot of that stemmed from Jeff's relationships and success at Warby Parker, right? He was able to tap into that investor network. And I mean, look, if Jeff had hit me up to invest in Harry's, I would have said yes, especially after his success of Warby Parker. So, you know, it was on track with, you know, kind of investor sentiment in terms of, you know, doubling down on founders after they've started at least, you know, one startup. And so, you know, that's how they're able to purchase 1 million blades to start, as they raise a $4 million seed round, which was a pretty big seed round at the time. I mean, they kind of skipped that initial MVP, if you will. I mean, they had samples and whatnot, but, you know, they just went kind of full swing with a big PO to start, which is pretty cool to see.
I mean, when you've got a second time founder who's like, yeah, I know what to do, then it's easier to write those bigger checks. But did you see any of the stories of when they were trying to work with this German factory?
Yeah, because they didn't speak German. So,
well, it was also like, you know, they didn't know about Warby Parker. That was an American thing. So they're like, okay, cool. You have an eyeglass company. We don't care. But then they would go back and forth and do Google Translate, because they didn't speak German and they didn't speak English very well. And they would just check these emails, because you know how like people will respond back to an email and then you'll see the other stuff that they respond back to. They would go back and look at those emails and look at them through Google Translate. And it would be things like, hey, the American boys want to buy these sorts of things. Or, oh yeah, those cowboys want to do this. And so it was very much of a, you know, are these guys wasting our time sort of thing? And they had to do a lot to gain credibility with that one. It was pretty funny.
Yeah, no, it's a great tidbit of a story. And I think too, it's interesting how they split up the company, because they each kind of became co-CEO, which is pretty uncommon. I mean, 50-50 split is how they did it. And I'm curious, I mean, what are your thoughts on that? Because on one hand, you have Jeff, who is a seasoned founder at this point, and you have Andy, and this is kind of his, you know, first rodeo. it sounds like Andy kind of found the gap in the shaving industry. But I mean, what are your thoughts on them both being co-CEO and that split?
You know, it's interesting because I think that co-CEO was something that wasn't really known before Harry's. But now, I mean, Hubble Contacts had co-CEOs for a long time. And lots of other companies are popping up with this co-CEO thing. And we'll get to this later, just about the impact that Harry's has had on the startup ecosystem. But I think a 50-50 split is awesome. You know, I think it's one of these things where they're both into this. They're both like leaning in and saying, okay, here's what we're going to do. Here's how we're going to do it. And to some extent, you know, Andy probably could have asked for a little bit more because it seemed like he was doing a lot of the legwork. And Jeff was still working in investment banking and didn't quit his job at the same time that Andy did. And so I think that the 50-50 is an important thing. And at the end of the day, you know, whether it's a 40-60 or a 50-50, that's probably not going to be that big of a dollar change, you know, if you're exiting for billions of dollars, right? You're going to be okay with 50% versus 60%.
Totally. Yeah. And then after their seed round, they hired a COO who I think you've met, right?
Yeah. Shout out to Will Freund. He is he's a fantastic guy. When we were starting Hubble Contacts, so one of the founders of Hubble came from Harry's, Ben Kogan, a good guy. And Will was kind enough to volunteer his time and just sat with me multiple times just to say, hey, here's how you build a startup. Here's what you do. And I was just coming from Unilever. This was my first startup. And so I just remember him being very sharp, very kind, and always very generous with his time to be willing to help. And he's a brilliant supply chain practitioner. And he was actually part of a Gilt Group before he joined Harry's and was really instrumental in kind of that growth. And so, love Will. He's a great guy.
That's awesome. We'll have to have him on sometime. But I'm curious because did Will ever talk about why they didn't begin as a subscription? Because to me, that would seem like a natural fit. And, you know, that's how Dollar Shave Club started. And I'm just curious. I mean, they really leaned into selling bundles rather than subscriptions. Do you know kind of the thesis of that decision?
So I don't know specific, but I thought about this as well. And I think there's two reasons for it. Is one, Recharge didn't exist when they started. You just think about that and like, you know, Recharge and Order Groove and all these other subscription companies didn't exist. So that was probably a big thing. They'd have to build it from scratch. Then two, this really wasn't a thing, right, in the early 2010s is people didn't sign up for subscriptions for product goods. This is right at the beginning where tech venture money is coming into this space and they're kind of pushing people to mimic SaaS. And so it was an element where I think it was just like, yeah, people are going to come back and order. And, you know, we know that in order to increase the AOV, we're going to have to sell bundles. And so I think it was probably more of a necessity versus a intentional decision.
Yeah, I mean, it goes to show how much they believe in their product because at the time of launch, they had 12 full-time employees, which is, I mean, to me, quite a bit for a D2C brand just launching. But they worked with two PR companies for their launch and saw a ton of more demand than they expected. So, you know, quote unquote, they said, we are not going to shave until our customers are shaving, which is pretty funny. And this was the promise they made when they launched. And they found it just increasingly difficult to meet growing demand. And they immediately started to get feedback and quickly learned that they would have to vertically integrate if they wanted to solve and act on customer feedback fast. And so this was already happening in 2012. Things were moving really fast. And they were worried that someone would buy their German manufacturer and kind of leave them out of business. You know, they had heard that this manufacturing facility was going for sale, but they needed $100 million to finance it. And so, you know, they went vertical. They had one of their early initial investors worked at Tiger Global. And so he helped pull together the funds from a syndicate of investors and get a loan from a German bank to actually buy their manufacturing facility, which is pretty incredible at this stage. I mean, do you think that was the right move at the time? What do you think went into that decision? And if you were kind of leading that, how would you approach your investors to say, hey, I know we're early, but we've got to go vertical here and spend $100 million to acquire our manufacturing facility?
Yeah. You know, I've thought about this one a lot. I don't know what I would do, to be honest. I mean, it was $65 million in equity, so that's dilutive. And then it was $35 million in debt. But the challenge is that, you know, you look at this and Gillette has a history, and P&G in particular has a history of just buying up manufacturers, buying up suppliers, and choking competition. And so, you know, I think that's a very real risk where if they were doing well, then, you know, and they were starting to cause pain to Gillette, that they would go out and acquire that factory and kind of take it out from under them. And you can do other things where you are, you know, having long-term agreements with that factory saying, hey, you know, you have to support us for the next 10 years, you know, if you get acquired or things like that. But, you know, I think that realistically, it was probably the right decision to purchase the factory. I think they probably did it a little bit early because I think, you know, a couple years in, they're, you know, $100 million, not even $100 million in revenue. And to think that Procter & Gamble is worried about Harry's more so than someone else, like a Dollar Shave Club, that might have been a little bit of hubris where they were just assuming that like, hey, I got to do this because someone else is going to come get it. But really, there was only other, there's one other game in town, and that was Gillette. And so, you know, the counter argument to that is if you wait for a couple years and you buy it 5 or 6 years in, you're bigger, then obviously you've got more of that that factory capacity is already dedicated to you in general. And by owning it, you're able to invest sooner. You're able to, you know, bring your costs down faster. And so right, wrong, or indifferent, they did it and it worked out wonderfully for them.
Yeah. I mean, and to give context, this wasn't like a small manufacturing facility. I mean, there was 400 German workers there. And at the time, Harry's only had 30. So they're, you know, buying a pretty big team here. And there was a big, you know, clash in culture, right? I mean, their American team wanted to move fast, be agile, be innovative, and the German team kind of thought that they were just unknowledgeable about the industry. And so there was definitely a clash of cultures at the beginning, but now they definitely consider that integration of their factory to be a competitive advantage and a key part of their growth. And so I think it was the right decision at the time. I think it was definitely an early decision to make, but it was, you know, pretty amazing to just verticalize that. And I also think too, you know, they added more assets to their balance sheet, right? Now they own this factory. Will that be good or bad? In the long run, it's worked out for them.
Yeah, wonderfully, yeah. So let's kind of fast forward to 2016. And this is a seminal year in the history of Harry's. How did things radically change for them?
Yeah, so, you know, Harry's was kind of growing like without competitors really noticing them. And then they go into Target and they quickly took 50% of the market share in Target, and it blew everyone's expectations. This is when kind of competitors really realized, you know, wow, this Harry's company is taking market share pretty quick. And, you know, the founders really expressed pride with this, right? Because before Harry's went into retail, you know, Target, their razor aisles were just filled of Gillette product, right? And other, you know, similar competitors. And so Harry's, I think, really stood out at Target, really resonated with the customer, as we talked about, in terms of their branding and persona as a brand. And so, you know, that was a huge shift for them to expand into retail, which, you know, catapulted the brand to even more growth. I'm curious, I mean, how difficult do you think it was for them to expand into retail, Aaron?
Well, let me just talk about in general and then talk about the Harry's in particular. So it's hard to go from D2C to retail. The cash economics are completely different. You know, rather than being paid and then shipping your goods, you're holding a bunch of goods and then getting paid 45 or 60 days later. You know, it takes a different type of marketing muscle. It takes a different type of calendar planning. So it is a big deal. I think the most interesting thing about this is in 2016, this was kind of the beginning of the hype of everything being subscription. Every VC wanted to see CAC to LTV, and it was all about lowering your churn, making sure that people got into subscription and then couldn't get out of it. And so for Harry's to come into this and say, you know what, we're okay losing some portion of our subscribers. We're okay not being able to track everything. And they went into this, you know, and probably some internal debate thinking that we're going to hurt our metrics, which may hurt our ability to fundraise. But at the same time, they said, hey, this just seems like a good idea. We'll figure it out. Like if we're making money, if we start to be doing the right things and making waves, we're going to get the benefit of those tailwinds that are happening there. And so again, they broke the mold here with what everybody else was doing in the D2C space by being the first one to go into retail. And they really paved the way for a playbook that everybody points to and says, oh yeah, this is what you should do now.
So Gillette comes in and sees Harry's taking market share in Target. And what do? They launch a welcome back campaign addressing their customers that switched to Harry's and then supposedly switched back to Gillette. To me, I think this was actually like a pretty good marketing strategy at the time. Like if I was on Gillette's marketing team, I'd be like, oh, this is like a pretty good way to kind of, you know, inform Harry's customers that, hey, you're going to, you know, come back to Gillette anyway. But what was really cool in terms of what Harry's did is they then go and publish a letter that their lawyers written responding to Gillette, showcasing the actual data and facts showing that Harry's is winning more and more market share and that their statement is a blatant lie, kind of, you know, really pushing people to think that Gillette, you know, is lying and you can't trust them, which damages their brand, of course. And so it's kind of that classic case of the Goliath picking on the David, and it was not a good strategy. And so after Harry's response, Gillette ditched the campaign and this marketing strategy completely. So I think Harry's had a great response to this, you know, welcome back campaign. I mean, did you see this campaign, Aaron? What were your thoughts when you saw it?
I didn't see it when it happened, but I obviously saw it there. It reminded me a little bit of the opening that Victoria's Secret gave Third Love. And, you know, I don't know why these big companies start like picking on these startups. Again, these startups are doing tens of millions or hundreds of millions of dollars, so they're not small companies anymore. But it's like as soon as you start talking about your competition, you validated them. Like they've won to some degree. And the best thing they could have done is just ignore them. But yeah, it was pretty interesting.
Yeah. I mean, look at our, you know, Third Love episode, last episode. And it's a very similar story where Victoria's Secret CMO picked on Third Love. And Third Love took advantage and just, you know, totally turned it into a great, great marketing strategy. But so in 2020, an exit opportunity shows up for Harry's. How do they react? What do they do, Aaron?
Yeah, so Edgewell is a company that had spun out of a bunch of other companies, had bought other personal care brands, Schick Shaving being one of the premier ones. And they start talking to Harry's. And at first, Harry's actually approached Edgewell and wanted to buy them. But they weren't able to do so. And through that process, they had kind of gained a lot of trust. And so Edgewell's like, hey, like, why don't we buy you? And let's call it a merger. And so really the idea was that Edgewell was going to write the check, but then Andy and Jeff were going to come in and run the combined company. And so it was a reverse merger that way. And they thought, hey, this sounds pretty good. Edgewell has decades of experience. They've got a lot more capacity. It would be really easy to kind of put the Schick and Harry's muscle together. And that's kind of what the thought was. That was the idea. And the problem is that the FTC looked at this and said, Harry's has been too successful. Right? They're too good at being a disruptor. And they said, quote, the loss of Harry's as an independent competitor would remove a critical disruptive rival that has driven down prices and spurred innovation in an industry that was previously dominated by two main suppliers, one of whom is the acquirer. And so it was one of these things where, again, Harry's had grown to be considered an equal to some extent with Gillette and Schick. And the FTC said, no, we want to keep that competition and we don't want to do that. So it wasn't a surprise when the deal was killed, but it was a huge hit on the team. And it was one of these things where, you know, the team had, for I think over a year, had been talking about how they were going to integrate and maybe we're checking the paper value of their options and how much they were going to take personally. And so it was really, really difficult. I remember having quite a few friends that it was hard for them. A lot of them left after that point in time because they're like, hey, this was our option. This is where we're going to go. Like, I'm not going to be able to get this anymore. And actually, the Washington Post wrote an article about how Harry's fixes shaving but breaks its exit strategy. And so I'm just curious your thoughts. Like, what do you think contributed to Harry's missing their exit window?
Yeah, I mean, to me, I guess I wonder what, you know, scrutiny the lawyers put into practice when they were doing this deal in terms of will the FTC block this or not, right? To me, looking back on it, you know, it seems, I don't want to say obvious, but like a hard deal to get through with the FTC knowing that they had been blocking a lot of these deals already. So, I mean, if I was on the team of Harry's at the time when the deal got blocked, I mean, it was probably a huge culture just conundrum to face, right? Because you're thinking, oh, you know, our stock's finally worth something, we're getting this big payday, and you know, all of a sudden the deal doesn't go through, right? And so it must have just been a shock for the team. And you know, I think it goes to show the resilience of Andy and Jeff to, you know, continue to grow Harry's, that, you know, we'll kind of dive into now. But I guess before we dive into the scale that they've gotten to today, after the FTC has blocked, you know, this acquisition, do you want to kind of, you know, give a rundown of the company milestones year by year, just so people understand, you know, their fundraising and key milestones from a revenue standpoint too?
Sure. So the story starts in 2012 when Andy and Jeff start Harry's in September. And again, initially with bundles. By 2013, they'd figured out that the subscription business was a good way to go. They raised a $10.5 million Series A from Tiger Global. In 2014, so again, 18 months after they launched, they bought their factory. And that included a $65 million Series A from Tiger, and then two additional venture rounds that equaled $132 million. And then it had a Series B with 12 additional investors for $75 million. So they raised a lot of money in a short period of time. They thought it was a good idea. So 2015, they raised $97 million more. And in 2016 was when they first launched into Target. 2017, $112 million more dollars raised. And in 2017, the first numbers we have is that they were doing about $200 million in revenue. I believe half of that was coming from Target. 2018, they raised the $112 that we talked about. And that was used to fund this division called Harry's Labs, which we haven't really talked about so far on the podcast. But it was this idea that they were going to launch new brands or acquire early stage startups. And so just thinking about becoming a CPG platform. And so one of the first things that they did that first year was they launched a women's shaving line called Flamingo. Very obvious next brand to launch. But they've also since merged into they launched a company called Cat Person, which is cat food. 2019, they talk about the merger with Edgewell. And this is when Harry's becomes profitable for the first time. And it's estimated they were doing about $310 million in revenue. 2020, the FTC sues to block the merger. They're doing $370 million in that year. 2021, they do $155 million Series E. And they start losing money again because they're doing more investments in their supply chain. And they're estimated to do about $450 million in 2021. And then 2022, they raise $140 million. And they do 115 from private equity, and they're doing about 550 in revenue. And the last numbers that we could find was in 2023, they were doing about $750 million in revenue and are rumored to be preparing for an IPO.
Yeah, it's pretty incredible growth story. I mean, $750 million last year in revenue is incredible. And, profitable. You know, I think it shows the resilience, like I was saying, of their team to, you know, have this acquisition be blocked and then continue to grow the company. Like, it's very rare that happens. And I mean, it's just pretty mind blowing to see the scale that they've gotten to today. I mean, there's been rumors of an IPO. Do you think that's going to happen? Or?
I think that's a foregone conclusion because I mean, the reality is they need to show some liquidity to their investors and to their employees. And like, they have all these options. And so like the IPO is the only way to go. And I think it's kind of funny that they were blocked by the FTC. And so kind of the collective reaction of the company is screw you guys. We'll just double our business. And that's what they did in the next 3.5 years. And so I fully expect an IPO to happen in 2024 or 2025.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, the other big exit to note in this space was Dollar Shave Club that sold for $1 billion to Unilever, which was a huge exit for the DTC world at the time. But, you know, along this way, they've done a ton of different activations and partnerships. They've got, you know, limited edition bundles that they've done, you know, with tote bags with Topo Designs, detoxifying face masks with Heyday, limited edition boxers with Sleep Jones. And so they continue to collaborate with more and more of these DTC brands and expand, you know, with really being intentional when it comes to working with these brands.
I think my favorite one was for a period of time, they had a 24-karat gold razor handle that you could purchase. This sounds like something that Liquid Death would do.
Yeah.
But, you know, they did. I don't think you get them anymore because it was just a partnership with Barney's. But that was a pretty funny one that they did.
Maybe we should connect Harry's and Liquid Death. For those that don't know, that are listening for the first time at e-commerce on tap, we did a Liquid Death episode that is amazing, and I'm drinking a Liquid Death right now. So there we go. Tune into that one. But Aaron, you've been a subscriber since 2016. So tell us about the customer experience, and let's do a deep dive on their supply chain.
Yeah. So just as a consumer, the subscription service is extremely customizable. And so what I mean by that is that you're able to dictate how often you want deliveries. And as opposed to in the past with other subscription things, I've had to say, hey, we're going to give to you every month or every week. And you're just kind of locked into it. And so several years ago, I adjusted the frequency to something that works for me. And I literally set it and forget it. It's the perfect type of subscription. And whenever I feel like I'm running low, I always get a notification like, oh, your order's on its way. I'm like, perfect. I figured this out. And so I'm able to use the product without having a ton of product building up under my sink. Some interesting things that they do is they offer some mystery items for about $5, which you can throw into your subscription order. And it's usually other personal care products, things that they're either testing or things that they're selling. From a tracking perspective, they're using Aftership for post-purchase. And so the interesting thing that they do is if you look at the Aftership page that they have, you know, maybe one third of it is the actual tracking information that I'm interested in. But then they use most of the real estate, two thirds of it, for advertising other products or talking about some of the other things that I could add on to my shipment. And so it's been really interesting from that perspective. And they're starting to sell things from shampoo and body wash to deodorant and beard care to lotion and shaving cream. So they're all over that. They also offer free engraving on their handles, which is interesting. I've actually been to their warehouse as well. And at least this was several years ago when we were starting Hubble. But at that point, they had an engraving machine kind of in the corner. And there's one person whose sole job was to go through and write people's names on the handle. And so it was an interesting one.
Wow. yeah. And so from a shipping experience too, they use USPS for their delivery. Sounds like it takes about 5 days on average from Fosdick, Connecticut to where you're at in North Carolina. Is that
Fosdick
right?
Fosdick is their fulfillment center, yeah.
Got it. And they sell, I mean, I was kind of surprised by this because from our research, they only sell in 6 countries, which, I mean, on one hand is incredible to be at that scale, only selling in 6 countries. But on the other hand, I would have thought by now they would have expanded more internationally. I mean, what do you think the reason is for that?
Well, I think that two parts is one, they were trying to figure out if they're going to sell themselves, right? If they're going to be acquired. And knowing that you've got a brand as strong as Harry's that's executing as well and saying, oh, I can just go plug this into Australia, South Africa, Middle East, whatever I need to, that's a great way to grow your business. But I think as they prepare for an IPO, I mean, this is a great story to sell potential investors because it's like, yeah, they're doing well in the US and Canada and the UK, but they have so much more potential. You look at where Gillette is and you know, that's the target that they have on their back. And so I think that they're doing it the right way where they're not trying to be everywhere and kind of mediocre, but they're really being thoughtful about the markets that they're executing on.
Yeah, it makes sense. And they offer different shipping, you know, options as well when you're buying online, whether it be 1 to 2 days, 2 to 4 days, 5 to 8 days. So I think it's good to give optionality for customers like that. 30-day return policy for their products. And is a special steel that they buy from Sweden for their razor blades that they produce in Germany. I didn't know that. It's kind of a neat special steel. Interesting.
Yeah. I'll kind of jump down to the manufacturing process for a moment, but it is so hard to make these razor blades we talked about, and they actually liquefy the steel to some extent as part of their proprietary process in order to make it hard and brittle enough to put that hard edge on there. And so you think about the workforce that has to be able to do that, the machinery that does that consistently, and then those feedstocks coming from a specific area in Sweden to be able to do that. You know, it's a big deal. And so they've really got that supply chain dialed in with their acquisition. And so that is a competitive advantage today. But they're also sourcing lots of other products. And so, you know, the handles and for the most parts are coming from China. The skincare products are coming from Spain and the UK. Shaving creams and other personal care things are coming from New Jersey. And the way that they've set things up is that in most cases, the personal care products are going straight to the warehouse in Connecticut. But the razor blades are going from Germany to China, where they are packaged and assembled. And then those are then shipped to the warehouse in Connecticut. And like I said, I've been to Fosdick. It's an interesting one. They do a good job. They are very much a low cost provider and are very good with high volume stuff. So Harry's is a great spot for them. But I remember, so much when we were starting Hubble, again, coming with this Harry's connection, people are like, well, just use the Harry's warehouse, just use Fosdick. And so there have been probably 36 startups that I know that just started there because that's what Harry's did. And that's kind of where they came from. And, that's not always the right case for young startups that are just getting started. But it was an interesting piece for sure.
That is interesting. And I think we have a pretty strong product strategy as well. I mean, one thing that I think hit home for me is they're always listening to their customers and trying to resonate with their customers. They have kind of a better than mentality. So if they want to make something, they make sure that it's better than the alternatives that are on the market. And, they heard, for example, that, Harry's customers wanted a body wash, and rather than just, white labeling one and putting their logo on it, they talked to their customers and their customers said, hey, we're tired of, smelling like a teenager, and they wanted something more sophisticated. And so, that's what they did. So they really focused in on listening to their customers when it comes to their product strategy. And I think their factory strategy is pretty impressive as well. Verticalizing, obviously they were able to improve their margins. So they were initially paying 50 cents per cartridge, but they were able to eventually reduce their cost to about 30 cents with that, vertical integration of their factory. And so I think this kind of strategy of buying a factory contrasts to a lot of DTC brands. I mean, what do you think about that in general? And just kind of give us your thoughts, because I don't think we've ever covered a brand on e-commerce on tap that has bought their own factory.
No, I mean, maybe Italic will one day, but you're absolutely right. Most people are perfectly content to partner with an expert in that area and to put their logo on it. And that is fine. And that's a great way of doing it. I think that Razor's is a unique place. And so if you just compare the path that Harry's went down versus Dollar Shave Club, Harry's is now so much bigger than Dollar Shave Club. It's more profitable. It is, all of that, despite Dollar Shave Club having sold for $1 billion to Unilever. And Dollar Shave Club, they took the traditional startup approach. They sourced directly with a factory called Dorco in Korea. And there really wasn't much differentiation in their products versus other products that were sold by Dorco. And so much so that their razors, the Dorco razors, ended up showing up on Amazon. And people could be like, oh, I like the Dollar Shave Club razor. Here's the exact same thing that doesn't say Dollar Shave Club, and I can get it for half the cost. And so as a result, that Dollar Shave Club ended up moving away from Dorco to a new partner in Israel. And this kind of caused a big backlash by customers, or at least caused an event, because the razors were inherently different. They may have been better, but they were just different. And so like we talked about, if you're used to shaving with a particular type of razor, anytime you change, you're going to cut yourself, because your face has to get used to that to some extent. And so it's an interesting piece there. And it could have been that this was just the shaving industry in general versus kind of a rule for everybody, but kind of building that credibility was the key thing.
Yeah. And I think too, they've really become like a powerhouse and growth platform for other brands in the space. We talked a bit about their exit opportunities, but at this scale, there's so much that they can do, right? So they launched their own brands internally. We talked about their women's brand, Flamingo. We talked about their cat food brand, Cat Person. But then they also acquired Mando and Loom, which they bought in 2021. And so I think it's just really a unique position to be in, because number one, they have scale, but not only do they have scale, but they also have operation efficiency, and just they have such a skillful team to be able to drive this growth, especially after the FTC blocked that acquisition. And so to me, I think it's just incredible what they've done. They're definitely going to IPO. From our research, it looks like they might have confidentially filed, but we're not 100% sure on that. But, we'll see. I mean, would you buy Harry's stock in the public markets, Aaron? What do you think?
I think so. I think that there's a long runway ahead of them, and they're just getting started.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think it's really an incredible business. I mean, what do you think the future is for them? Are they going to expand more internationally? Are they going to continue to acquire and grow their own brands? And I mean, what do you think in general of this kind of like studio aggregator model for Harry's right now?
Yeah, well, they've kind of come out and said what their ambition is, and that's to be the next P&G. And it was interesting because when I was leaving Unilever and joining Hubble Context, part of my ambition for wanting to do so was because I was hoping that a company would emerge that would be the 21st century, you know, great CPG company that's out there. And, you know, I had ambitions that, hey, maybe that could be Hubble or it could be something else, but something that is D2C native, has those roots, is able to innovate, is able to have these retailer distributions, able to kind of keep growing and be profitable and those sorts of things. And of all the companies that we've covered, all the companies I've studied, Harry seems to be the one that is the farthest along to becoming a true CPG conglomerate. They've got a lot of work they need to do. They've got some large acquisitions and things that they have to think about, but there's no reason why that couldn't be their future. And so I think that to that extent, if you have that as the goal, that as the context, then yeah, the hybrid venture studio or the aggregator model makes sense because they're profitable today. They are not just acquiring small brands in the hopes of making them big. They have built a big brand and they have good research for how they can leverage that to with other things. But you know, it's going to be costly. They're not going to hit on everything that they try. And they have to be really disciplined in starting things and stopping things. And so I think that's going to be the biggest challenge for them, is they have to be willing to kill brands, to kill products, to kill initiatives if it doesn't meet that threshold that's going to propel them to being a, you know, the next version of a P&G or Unilever.
Right. Yeah, I think that's a key point, is they have to be diligent on what opportunities they dive into, because at their scale, you know, a company that's doing $10 million is not going to move the needle for them. And so they really have to think at scale. It almost reminds me of, like, you know, these tech companies like Google or Apple that you hear like, oh yeah, we launched, you know, Google Chat and it had, you know, 100 million users, but we're going to, you know, stop building it because it's not enough for us. Right. And so I think they really have to have that scaled mindset, which is a lot different than them, you know, as a startup. Right. And they've really matured as a business. And I think it's pretty incredible to see, because both Andy and Jeff are still co-CEOs. They, you know, continue to lead Harry's, and it's just an incredible story. I mean, this has been one of my favorite companies that we've covered on e-commerce on tap. What are your takeaways? What do you want to leave the listeners with this story?
So I was thinking about this a lot, and Harry's journey in many ways is over as a startup, and it's just beginning as a public company or a proper CPG company. And I can't begin to overestimate the impact and the legacy that Harry's has had on the startup ecosystem in general, and in particularly in New York, where I spent so many years. I was curious about this as we were doing the research, and I went into LinkedIn, into Sales Navigator, and I just searched for people that worked at Harry's and had the title founder or CEO. And there were 78 people that popped up that had that combination. And, you know, you just think about like how many other ideas and experiences and just what a fantastic place for people to work and to gain experience, to learn from some of the best, and then to be able to have that confidence, say, you know what, I can go do this. And to also come from a place that investors will see that, like, oh wow, you were so-and-so at Harry's. We know you know what you're doing. We know what you're doing at scale. And so it's almost the equivalent of coming from Apple these days, right? And so just the idea that they you know, are giving birth to so many other ideas, so many other founders, is a great place to come from. The fact that they, and several times, have broken the mold, whether it be starting subscriptions and being one of the first to start subscriptions in the CPG space, to breaking that mold and getting into retail, and now literally being the playbook that every other D2C company is going after. I can't begin to overestimate the respect and the love that I have for them being someone in this ecosystem.
Yeah. It's incredible to see. I mean, especially to hear that stat. I mean, that's an amazing statistic that they've, you know, really either inspired or helped, you know, almost 80 other founders come from Harry's. I mean, that's incredible. I love that. I really do love that. This was an awesome episode of E-commerce on Tap. I mean, I really enjoyed this. I hope everyone tuning in did as well. If you liked it, please subscribe, share with a friend. Leave a comment for Aaron or I on LinkedIn or Twitter. And thank you again to listening in to this episode of E-commerce on Tap, brought to you by Sourcify and Izbuzz.